Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, marking this year's Day of Remembrance and the 79th anniversary of Executive Order 9066 by learning about a new book that captures what life was like before, during, and after the internment of 120,000 Americans of Japanese ancestry. Tears of Honor uses a mix of real historic figures and some fictional names that combine the true stories of multiple Japanese Americans. One of the names that hasn't been changed is that of a Korean American who was assigned to an all-Japanese American unit and became one of America's most decorated soldiers. We're going to hear about that soon from James Ardiz, the author of the book, but to set a little context, let's hear a brief clip from one of the many Nisei veterans we've had the privilege of hearing from on Hometown Heroes. This is Sherman Kishi describing some of his memories as a teenager forced off the land where he'd been born in Livingston, California.
Very shortly after going into the camp, we had some very well-educated people who had gone to college, unable to get jobs because jobs weren't available to people of Japanese descent. And so they were well-educated, and they immediately started things within the camp. And one of the things that started was baseball. And baseball became a very popular pastime in Merced Assembly Center, as it was in the later relocation camps. So there were things like talent shows. I remember very vividly one talent show that we went to that had a young lady from Walnut Grove who had a beautiful contralto voice, and one of the most popular songs that was sung at the time was God Bless America. Can you imagine? Yeah, that's what happened during those days, yeah.
And the irony, huh? God bless America when you're basically being held prisoner by America.
That's exactly right.
You can link to that complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com, but that brief anecdote from Sherman Kishi parallels the dichotomy James Ardiz explores in his new book, Tears of Honor.
Well, the one question that I decided I wanted to answer in this book was, why did these young men go and do what they did? And why did their parents support that? The answer came back fairly quickly, but I didn't want it to be cliche. I mean, the real answer to that was because we're Americans and we were fighting for our country too, even though our country did something that was wrong, and they were able to separate that. So you even saw the folks at home in these detention centers waiting for telegrams about their sons, just like everybody else, and getting those, you know, Western Union telegrams saying that their son had been killed in action. And you saw mothers worrying. You saw sons fighting. The evolution of the 100th 442nd in not just becoming an all-Japanese combat unit, but being a go-to unit that when you needed something difficult to be done, they were the ones that were called upon. You know, there are people that think that the Japanese-American units were hurled into hopeless situations because they were expendable. I never found that. What I found was, the unfortunate thing is that when you're the toughest unit around, you're going to be called for the toughest situations. And I really think that that played more of a role than, you know, throwing men into difficult situations. When you see what happened at Monte Cassino, for example, which was horrific, and talking to men that were there, I found that they were there fighting alongside other units, but they were there because they needed somebody to punch through, and by God, these guys could, they did it. I mean, they did it, and I'm not sure now when I look at what we have there that, honestly, that generationally we have the same stuff. I'd like to think we do, but when I talked to these men and I read about what they did and tried to write about it and make it live for readers today, you can't look at that without thinking, I'm making this stuff up. And the answer is no. This is very carefully documented. And I used fictional characters to illustrate it, but I used the real commanders and everything else, what they did, what they said, you know, that's what happened. So what's in this book is what it happened to somebody or it really happened to the individual that is named in this book. I try to be very accurate about that.
You put it as a perception that they had been expendable. I think one of the reasons that perception has persisted over the years is the rescue of the Lost Battalion. A little more than 200 mostly white soldiers, the Texas Battalion, that are rescued by the 442nd, who suffers 800 casualties in doing so. So the ratio there, I think, is what makes people think, hey, they were expendable. Are you saying it was more about their tenacity and the go-for-broke mentality?
I think that's true. I think that the general that was in charge, from a military standpoint, it was a pragmatic military decision. I mean, in other words, I think he needed men that were going to go into a very difficult situation. He knew men were going to be lost to rescue this group. You have the fact that the Alamo Regiment, the Lost Texas Battalion, was basically white. You know, at that time, when they put these regiments together, they did it from geographic regions, so not like nowadays. So that's how you ended up with the Texas Battalion, the Alamo Regiment. So sending in the 100th, I don't think that the decision to send them in had to do with the fact that they were expendable. I think it had to do with the fact that they were the toughest unit around, and they knew that they would do what needed to be done. And then, of course, people look at it and say, well, gee whiz, the people they rescued were all white. And that's true, but I don't think you would hear men that were there at Bellefontaine and rescued the Lost Texas Battalion saying that they thought they were there because they were not white. I certainly think the men that were rescued, and I got the opportunity to talk to them, at least two of them, I don't think that entered into it at all, other than, you know, these units were not well known. The story of the Lost Texas Battalion is such a fantastic story in and of itself. But when they were rescued, they see these, what they described as little brown men running from tree to tree, and they realize they're Japanese, but the Japanese are part of the Axis powers, and they're trying to figure out how the Japanese got, you know, why are they here? So they didn't really know about these units. These units were not that well publicized.
And there's a character that emerges in your book that is not a fictional character, that's a real-life character who you got to spend a lot of time with, Young Oak Kim. What is it about his profile, the arc of his actions in World War II and beyond, that really captivated you and made him such a central figure here?
When I was researching, the same name kept coming up in different actions. Young Oak Kim, a Korean. And I thought, well, how did a Korean end up in a Japanese unit? As I read about him, when he graduated at Fort Benning as a lieutenant, at that time, everybody got their orders, and he didn't get any orders because nobody wanted him because he was Asian. And he graduated at the top of his class. And ultimately, he was sent to the 100th, and he didn't even know about the Japanese-American unit. He didn't know where he was going. And he went to the 100th, and when he showed up, the first comment that the white officers made, because most of the ranking officers in the 100th, which was the unit that came out of Hawaii, were white. They said, you're Korean. Japanese don't like Koreans. Koreans don't like Japanese. And so you can leave. And he said, no, I'm not going to leave. And the commander said to him in a well-documented conversation, well, you're going to have to get used to them. And he said, well, they're going to have to get used to me. And it just struck me. And I thought, and I started reading about this man. He just seemed like such an unusual character. And the more I read about him, the more I realized that we were talking about a man who was really a great American hero. I mean, he was a highly decorated. He was one of the most decorated men to come out of World War II. And I've often said he was kind of like the Asian Audie Murphy. I mean, I was stunned. I decided to use him as an arcing character because he went through so many of the battles. So I was fortunate to be able to spend 6 months interviewing him. He fought in World War II, in Korea, and in Vietnam, and was just an absolutely heroic figure. I mean, I use that term, but that's when you read about what he did, which is so well documented, and you talk to him, he's just kind of an awe-inspiring figure. I interviewed him at the Go for Broke Foundation in Los Angeles. Go for Broke is the motto of the 442nd, so they have a foundation, and a lot of these old veterans gather there. It's not really a clubhouse, but it does have an area like that. And I watched Colonel Kim walk in, and he walked in on a walker, and here were all these old guys, all of them who had been scarred by real battle. And it was like watching Moses walk across the Red Sea. I'd never seen anything like it. I mean, everybody stood up when he walked into the room and they just spread. And I realized that among what we would call heroes, and I think we use that term a little too generously nowadays, but among what were real heroes, he was the guy that they parted for. So I knew that he was something special. And I got to spend a tremendous amount of time talking to him. He had lived through the worst times of World War II. He was the intelligence officer that was, in my view, personally responsible for gaining the intelligence to move the 5th Army off the beachhead at Anzio whenever they were basically trapped there. And when you read about what he did, it was like, I mean, when he told me what he did, and I already knew what he did, I mean, I wanted to say, are you nuts? It was just, you know, you think, people think you're making it up.
And can you give us an example of that? I mean, I want people to read the book, Tears of Honor, and learn about young Oak Kim and some of the other exemplary characters here. But is there like a particular action or mindset or courage that he displayed in a situation that was really one of those things that grabbed you that said, boy, how can I be sitting here talking to this guy right now?
Well, I'll use the example at Anzio. The American Army, 5th Army, Mark Clark's army was trapped. They needed intelligence. They knew that the Germans had panzer units and their Tiger tanks were coming in, and they had far more firepower than American tanks did. So the American Army was very much afraid of the panzer units, the Tiger units. They needed to know where the Germans were going to be. So the American Army was kind of at the beachhead. The Germans were on the other side, and it was kind of this weird no man's land thing where they would kind of come out and see each other, maybe wave a little bit, and then bomb the hell out of each other during the day and at night. So Kim volunteered to cross this no man's land, which was a large area of grass between the two armies, a ditch, and then the Germans were dug in and they had cement machine gun nests and that type of thing on the other side, and get prisoners. They needed prisoners. Well, it would be like crawling across a football field with grass about a foot and a half high. So Kim took another man, and when he volunteered, he was told no, that it was a suicide mission. He said, well, you need to take it up the chain of command. And so they did. And it finally, every commander refused except Mark Clark, who said, we've got to do it. And if he's willing to do it, okay. So he crawled across at night, and he always carried a machine gun, and he never wore a helmet. He only wore a knit beanie. He crawled across and waited until early morning hours, and then there was an open area covered by machine guns, and he crawled across the open area right next to a German pillbox. He could hear the Germans inside the pillbox, and he got over to a slit trench where a couple of German non-commissioned officers were sleeping. He stuck his Tommy gun in the mouth of one of the sleeping Germans so that when the man opened his eyes, he saw this Korean sitting there with a machine gun, a Tommy gun in his mouth. And the other man that he went across with, the man by the name of Irving Iwanoki, they then took those men in the sight of German machine guns, made them crawl back across this open road into the field, kept those prisoners until it was dark and all day long, and then crawled all the way back, getting the intelligence information that they needed to push through. Now, in me telling that, sounds like, well, yeah, you know, but he crawled several hundred yards. It would be like crawling 400 yards or 500 yards on your belly, and then in full sight of gun towers, crawling across, bringing prisoners back, keeping everybody quiet, and accomplishing what he did. Mark Clark gave him the Distinguished Service Cross when he came out on the spot, which is the highest award that a field commander can provide, other than the Medal of Honor, which, you know, has to be done separately. And it was just, you know, I mean, everybody regarded it as a suicide mission. When you read about what he did, you think he should have been dead every step of the way, and yet he never hesitated. Now, when he told me that story, he told it to me just about exactly the way I just told it to you. And it was like, with me sitting there thinking, what kind of a man am I talking to? He won the French Legion of Honor for separate engagements in France, the highest award that they could give. And when he was recalled to duty in Korea, he won the Korean Medal of Honor for a separate engagement. And then he won everything in between. But I mean, it's like saying, yeah, and then he got a couple of silver stars and he got a couple. You know, I mean, he's just, it was awe-inspiring to talk to him. But I think I've indicated there was no embellishment. There was no brag. There was nothing. It was just like a man saying, yeah, I went to work today and, you know, this is what I did. And he came back and he was just an amazing man. And he was regarded by the people around him as an amazing man. And when I was privileged to be invited to his funeral, and when I say to be invited, it was pretty much a closed type of thing. But there were these huge flower arrangements from the United States Army, from France, and from Korea. And there were field grade officers there from those countries. And then there were all these old men that had been part of the 100th, 442nd. And his remains were in an urn. And there was a picture of him in his full dress uniform as a colonel. They just kind of formed a line. And you'd see these colonels and generals walk up and salute. And then all these old men just walk up individually and salute. So you realize that it was a privilege to know somebody like this. This was a real American hero.
And you can learn about him in the new book, Tears of Honor. If you live near the author, James Ardaiz, in Central California, you can pick up that book at a book barn in Clovis. But wherever you're listening right now, you can order it online. I have a link up for you at hometownheroesradio.com and on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll have more about the book, more about Young Oak Kim, and more about the underlying theme of this labor of love that is something that couldn't be more timely or relevant. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.